All right. Like Ringer, we have reached the end. Anybody else watching that? Oh, I love that show. Sarah Michelle Gellar? Sorry. Okay. So, we are coming full circle back to day one, now with a whole semester's worth of theories, terminology, examples, case studies, to sort of come back and see where we started, see how far we've come, see what we can take with us as we go off. So, as we'd said at the beginning of this semester, in the terms of the question of why this course, why are we offering anthropology of the body course in bioethics, we had talked about how, on a very fundamental level, the body is present at every bioethical conflict, at every medical encounter, at every interpersonal interaction, but it is often sort of elided or pushed to the back. One of the authors this week described it as an absent body. It's a thing that is unproblematically assumed to be, in general, generally, it's redundant, to be generally considered a materialist entity, sort of the house for what really matters, unless you're talking about illness. That the multiple levels of the body within, again, healthcare experiences, conflicts, interpersonal relationships, there's no accounting for the multiple levels that a body is. Now, it's probably impossible to have a completely holistic view of all of these different things that the body is. The body is individual, the body is collective, the body is historically contingent, yada, yada. So in that sense, this course has been a survey course to give you a sense of the different possibilities, sort of opening up the idea that what we've unproblematically assumed for so long is actually quite problematic, why it's problematic, and a survey of other ways to think about it. And each discipline in each area will find areas within those different theoreticals or the epistemologies of the body that will be more relevant than others. So what I've hoped to do in giving the readings and organizing the lectures as I have is to think about a new lens. I use that term all the time, a new lens through which to view the problems that you're already encountering or foresee encountering, or have seen in the past and thought you'd understood and want to look at them again in a new way. Seeing the different types of questions that can be asked when the body is considered in a different way. You know, we were talking about embodiment. You know, the question of transplant takes on a whole other host of interesting questions to consider when we think about embodiment of organs and interpersonal relationships tied through the body. So new questions and new avenues through which to explore those questions. And I think this quote is in the Schick-Tantz article. One can call into question the tendencies of both analytical and also moral philosophy, as both center around notions of personhood, rationality, preferences, and self-determination, which are mainly conceptualized without any relation to the body, although bioethics often deals with problematic cases in which entities lack rationality and specific mental capacities, for example, embryos, brain-dead patients, animals, and so on. Bioethics is out of touch with bodies themselves in the phenomenological sense in which the being, or rather the becoming, this is key, this is where we're sort of going to end today, the becoming of the self is always intricately interwoven with the fabric of the body. All the authors at one point or another talk about this idea of this body boom, corporeal turn, and ask the question, why now? And Shepherd Hughes and Locke's articles in 87, they really were the foremothers of, at least in medical anthropology, and I think as it extended a lot to sort of feminist approaches and social science approaches and bioethics, to this idea that the body needs to be problematized. I mean, you go on Amazon and look up the body. It's no longer just sort of artsy fartsy books with photographs of the body. It's different disciplines theoretically analyzing what this body is. to the question of why now, now being sort of late 80s, picking up speed in the 90s, and so far continuing into the 2000s. Two theories in the articles for this week give a preliminary answer to that. And one is that in some ways it's the fact that the subjects of exclusion, those bodies who were not talked about or who were pushed aside or who were not given voice to talk about themselves, who were always talked about, women, disabled, the elderly, came to a point in these postmodern times in which they had the voice to critique their own exclusion and argue for their inclusion into the canon, into the theorizing, into the epistemology. I think there's a lot of weight to that. I think we've talked about that, those trends in the 80s in terms of theories of culture, very parallel arguments within bioethics and considering the body. The other theory put forth is that we're living in a time now of transgressions. And you know how anthropologists feel about transgressions. They are dangerous. They cause us to hole up. They reinforce dichotomies. But we're in a time in which there's a blending of relationships. There's technologies of the body that are making things possible. And we'll talk more later about specifically what those types of things are. Making technologies that are making it possible to do things with the body that were never, that were purely science fiction before. Philosophers often talk about the sort of the yuck factor, that they don't quite yet know how to articulate what exactly it is that is problematic about it, but there's something, there's something unnatural, whether, you know, inhuman. You know, the same sort of reaction I think we probably have to extreme forms of violence, where you can't understand it, and so you're drawn to a means to explain it. So the three articles today really relate to those two. What does it mean that we're paying so much attention to the body now? What's happening in the slinky of our culture to lead us to this point? Where can it possibly spiral off to next? So let's start with probably the most straightforward. I realize that some of these, and you can see why I didn't assign Latour or the Shostak article in the week one. I mean, I've read them four or five times, and every time I come, I'm like, So what I've tried to do today is sort of abstract, you know, the key points and those key paragraphs where you sort of get through three pages and they put it all in a paragraph. Like, aha, I've got it. So we'll highlight those. So Shepherd, Hughes, and Locke, I think, is one of the most well-written, most straightforward of the three pieces. And I think I hear Bridget. Okay. Hi, come on in. Some sort of universal understandings of, you know, how the world works. And
maybe empathy or something like that.
Well, no, here's the thing. It doesn't matter. It almost doesn't matter what they are. But I would throw out, yeah, you don't kill.
Right. Just the easy ones, right?
Well, but here's the difference. It's, you don't kill other people. It's a very important question. Who do you define as a person?
Sure.
You know, we've seen throughout history how people define others as not people. So,
and there are plenty of times when almost everyone agrees that it is okay to kill somebody, like self-defense or something like that. So even those aren't necessarily immutable.
I even think that's getting too complicated for the whole culture versus something inherent to humanness. You know, because people always go, well, what about the Brazilian baby killers? This is sort of their shorthand. You know, the ones that supposedly bury the incredibly deformed, aren't going to live very long children. We would call that infanticide. They don't, because a person doesn't become a person until there are certain rituals that take place and they are brought into the fold. And you could make functional arguments, you could make structural arguments, you could make environmental arguments about why that might have culturally developed as a way of looking at the world. So, yeah, do you care for your children? Every human, again, barring severe psychiatric illness, cares for their children. What that means in practice is completely different. Autumn gives a great lecture. I don't know if she does it in 601 or 602, where she talks about going to the gynecologist in the United States versus Germany. I think that's really an interesting, because you know, the idea that we all have senses of human. That was this semester?
Yeah, she was saying that in Germany, it's just like normal to be naked on the patient bed. You don't get a gown, you don't get a blanket.
She starts out with talking about
women not wanting to remove like their.
In the emergency room.
Not wanting to remove like a headscarf.
And their husband protecting their right to not take it off. And how American doctors say, well, my God, these people don't understand basic, you know, health care. You know, this is sort of a need. You know, what's the problem with headscarf? In the same idea that, you know, she says, if I were in Germany and I went to the gynecologist's office, they would expect me to strip off all my clothes without a gown, without anything, and just sit there. And my husband would demand something for me because of his idea of protecting me, my sense of whatever adjective that is that I'm blanking on. So protection of loved ones, universal. How that plays out, so completely different. And in that respect, I'm comfortable going all the way to the relativist camp. Which is, you can get too far where it's sort of like, you know, this is not a pencil.
Right.
You know, or you are not here. You know?
There's like no point in even talking about it then. Bioethics.
But it becomes real in practice, and that's where you got to.
Yeah.
In practice, it becomes real. Okay, it smells really good. So let's. No. Let me go through these bodies, and then we will feed our bodies and continue to talk about bodies. All right, so it's at the level of the individual body that we can sort of have access to, they say, data about social and cultural meanings of what it means to be human, of what it means to be well, what it means to think that you are ill or seek treatment when ill. In contrast, sort of going up a level, again, not in a hierarchical sense of up, a social body, in which the body becomes a symbol used to think about nature, about society, and about culture. It's this idea that the body is good to think with, or I think I like to say think through. I think that's a valuable turn of phrase. In the same way we were talking about stories, you know, these are not stories about illness, they're stories through bodies, they're stories through illness. There's a benefit to thinking of that trajectory through something. In terms of the extent to which it is interwoven to every cell. So it lets us, thinking about the social body is where we can start to talk about social constructions of knowledge. Body as metaphor. How we talk about sick societies and well societies and where societies need a little help. And then on another plane, you have the body politic, which refers to the relationship between individual bodies and social bodies. Centers exclusively on themes of power and control, as politics does. Politic. It looks at the real world effects on the individual of the social, but it's also the flip side. The effects on the social by the actions of individuals. And how the relationship between individual bodies and social bodies can be used by different groups to justify or to critique power. Each of those three different bodies has a distinct theoretical approach or an epistemology of how one might understand them. And again, this is I think it was from them that they say, no one question, no one area of study is going to possibly be able to incorporate all of these. But you need to know they're all there. In the same way that the, it's probably the grown-up is Jones. You can never remember to learn how to pronounce people's names. Schicktanz. When she says, part of why she has that matrix is to really sort of say, let's become critically aware of where we live epistemologically. so that then we can understand where other people might be coming from. Those of you who've done the mediation intensive, this should sound very familiar. So three different epistemologies. The level of phenomenology, which we know is sort of the idea of experience, how one moves through the world. The social body, which is approached through themes of structuralism and symbolism. And the body politic, which they say is post-structuralism. I'd be comfortable saying postmodernism, but it's just this idea that it's a more reflexive, intricate, intertwined way of looking at the world. And it has to add power. That's really the key. And I guess that's what they mean by post-structural. That a structuralist would just look at the structure and sort of say, well, how does this structure relate to this structure? How does it relate to this structure? What is the foundation? What is, you know, literally sort of like as a house. Whereas the post-structuralist would say, why was that house built there? Why was it built with two stories? What does it mean that it has stairs, you know, in terms of types of people who could live there? Does it have sidewalks? Is it a walkable neighborhood? You know, post-structuralist adds that element of critical context. Okay, any questions on because the next three slides are the different bodies. in general, sort of what they're doing, why they're doing it. Okay. So let's, everyone hop up, grab some pizza. While we're working our way back to the table, I want to start, see if somebody can, who's not chewing, sorry, old waitress trick, you start chewing and you say, how is everything? Great, okay, good. And you run away. Somebody want to tell the story of, when they introduce the section on the individual body, they talk about a headache sufferer in Grand Rounds. Did that story stand out to anybody? Yeah, Jennifer, can you tell us sort of, yes, keep going.
They were talking about her headaches and they couldn't, I believe, come up with exactly what was wrong with her. And the quote at the end, I remember highlighting it. What is it really? What is the headache really?
Back up a little bit, though.
Okay.
So, you know, doctor brings headache patient in, sits her down.
She told a horrible story. Everybody was empathetic of what was happening. Mm-hmm. But then they're like, well, wait a minute. What's really happening?
Yeah.
What's the real cause of the headache?
Mm-hmm. Because it can possibly, unfortunately, be a true story. A woman suffering from
Which is interesting because that I don't remember the horrible empathetic part. I remember them being empathetic, but wanting to go back to what was really wrong with her.
Yeah.
Not what she had gone
through. Not the alcoholic husband who's beating her. Not the senile incontinent mm-hmm. mother-in-law.
Yes.
Or the punk teenage son who was rebelling.
It's failing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's the real cause of these headaches? Now, the authors say that we might want to sort of give this med student the benefit of the doubt and say, all right, this student knows that this patient's life is hard, and that's probably having some effect on the headaches, but she's just really interested in what the neurological foundation of this pain is. Authors are going to try to show is that even thinking there is a biological process behind the headaches, meaning that what this woman is going through is not enough in and of its own, means that we are not uncontrollably, but really trapped in this radical materialism. This is sort of how we started this semester. We don't have the outlook or vocabulary to speak about an integrated system of health and illness, which is why they say we're left suspended in hyphens. Mind, body, biosocial, psychosomatic. Or my whopper, mind, or body, self, in action, in context. I mean, but there's no terminology through which, in English, here, in this culture, right now, to talk about that. They say there's evidence that we're trapped in this, in large part, this idea that, you know, that the medicalization of the social. Is this what they talk about, sort of uppity women becomes, you know, or frustrated women become women who's suffering from PMS. You know, sort of every time there's a social reason for people to behave a certain way, we medicalize it. They also talk about how there's an inherent doubt that has the potential, that's their expression, to, if they say, if we were able to question this mind, body, spirit, matter, unreal, real, and realize that they aren't quite so distinct, they say the fear is we would fall into the void, into the chaos of absolute relativism and subjectivity. So, again, I hope this class, as well as the last article that we're going to talk about, will show that these are not things to be feared, but to be embraced. They then talk about alternative conceptions to give us just a taste. It's not the point of the article to talk about these alternative conceptions. You can get that in a medical anthropology class. But to think of how, to see examples of other cultures and how they understand relationships among the mind, body, culture, nature, and society. How they put together the pieces of how this thing is separate from your thing. They start with sort of the basic classic of the idea of a yin and a yang, that the cosmos is in a state of dynamic equilibrium. We and the things around us exist sort of with and for each other, and the optimal state is balance between the two, not superiority of one over the other. Talks about traditions in Islam that stress the complementarity of all phenomenon within it. And Buddhism, which connects subjectivity to the entire being of the cosmos. I think they do a brilliant job on page 13, because you've gone through these two pages and you're like, okay, all right, I can kind of intellectually understand that. And then they throw in these two poems. 17th century Japanese haiku and a Tennyson poem. The Japanese poet writes, "When I look carefully, I see the Nazuna blooming by the hedge." In contrast, Tennyson writes, "Flower in the crannied wall, I pluck you out of the crannies. I hold you here, root and all, in my hand. Little flower, but if I could understand what you are, root and all in all, I should know what God and man is." Again, I think this idea that we think in metaphors and there's an interrelationship between different elements within a society, we can't claim that poetry is just poetry and it's just artistic. There's a worldview that underlies how and why things are written the way they are. So then they sort of point out that the Japanese poet is content to admire it from a distance for what it is, where it is, how it is, his relationship to it. Whereas Tennyson is active and analytical, plucks it out. As some medical scientists do, he would vivisect the flower. They say it's reminiscent of Bacon's description of the natural scientist as one who must, quote, torture nature's secrets from her and make her a slave to mankind. I think those are very clear examples of how there's a fundamental worldview difference between understanding how do we relate to others around us. Okay. So then they ask the question, what does an individual person look like in different societies? So you have this sort of understanding of what the body is, but then what is the self? The self can be considered distinct from the body. And again, they say we shouldn't assume or think that there are people out there who can't distinguish between the individual body self, note the hyphen, and another and other body selves, except again for cases like Sachs, is the man who mistook his wife for a hat or his hat for the wife, or that there are many different senses of the person separate from the Western notion of the individual as an autonomous being. They argue that this, that there are, that what we're talking about are different social conceptions of the person. This should just sort of, you should hear this in your sleep. You know, West, autonomous, permanent, unique, permanent consciousness, rationality, yada, yada. And then they give a couple more examples to show us, you know, there is nothing inherently natural about this. They say there's two other types. There's where individual body selves are intimately tied to the social body. And there are other cases, other societies, cultures, in which the individual is considered to be comprised of a multiplicity of selves. They use Japan as probably the most classic example, in which it is not the individual self that is the most fundamental and natural unit of society, but the family. There's, I don't know how to, the IE, it's a system of organization of Japanese businesses which mirrors Japanese families in terms of interrelationships and hierarchies and roles and duties and responsibilities. I've heard that, I think I've said this in this class before, in the U.S. we say the squeaky wheel gets the grease. You know, there's a problem, speak up, be squeaky, you'll get some grease, you'll solve the problem. In Japan, it's, you know, the misplaced peg gets the hammer. So, different conceptions of what it means to live in a society, how the individual body self is related to the social bodies. They talk about Japan as a culture of social relativism, in which the person is always understood in the context of social relations, never autonomously. And there have been some interesting analyses of how this plays out in debates and discussions about organ transplantation, for example. Then there's this idea that the individual is comprised of a multiplicity of selves. They cite the Bororo, the Kuna Indians of Panama, and the Zinakan Teiko. In the Bororo, the self is determined by who is considering the body. Those of you who study other languages know that there's often have to be language shifts depending on who you're talking to and how you're talking about them. I think I made the analogy in my head that this is somewhat similar, is that there is this thing, but there are multiple different ways to talk about it and to approach it and to interact with it, depending on the other players in the equation. So the self as perceived by parents is distinct from the self as perceived by other kinsmen, which is distinct as the self as seen by outsiders. They don't talk very much about it, the Zinakan Teiko, with the 13-part soul, and they sort of end with saying, if someone were to talk that way here in the West, they would get a psychopathological diagnosis. So then they sort of say, they go body, they go self, and then they go self and body image, tying the self-perception to its context. And they define body image as the collective and idiosyncratic representations an individual entertains about the body in relationship to its environment as a whole. To me, it was a very clear example. They talk about the patient's choice, and I put that in quotes to show what an active process it is. And again, to separate out the biological from the cultural. The choice of symptoms and how that relates to body image. Shepherd Hughes's Death Without Weeping, her ethnography of impoverished Brazilians. Mothers talking about their own breast milk as sour, curdled, bitter, and diseased. They say this is a metaphorical projection of these mothers' social positioning and their structural inability to pass on, as they say, anything untainted to their children. A good example of old stock Americans. And again, I think this idea of, you know, backbone, strong spine, upright, it's almost one of those dead metaphors because we don't really think about what it means anymore. But when you retie it to your spine and the idea of being industrious and strong and able-bodied, these ideas of how choice of symptoms and talking about them in terms of being laid on their back, being out of joint, these sorts of things take on an added significance, particularly when you contrast it with, because I think a lot of us kind of went, why on earth would you spend so much time talking about your bowels and cleanliness? they might, why do you spend so much time talking about your back? You know, really, is your back that much more important than your bowels? Probably not. Grand scheme of things. We all went to the Mutter, saw that guy. So what I like about this article a lot is how many cross-cultural examples they can give. Not so that we get, not so that we fully feel like, oh, I'm now an expert in Japan, but enough to be able to say, huh, there are alternatives. What does that mean? We can take two tacks. We can say, well, they're wrong, and ours is right. We are more advanced and civilized, which many people, that is the conclusion they reach. Or we can say, there's got to be something to the power of culture that is determining how individuals come to view the world in such distinct ways. And in that sense, relativism is good. Okay. So, I'm just going to keep barreling through. Interrupt at will. Let's talk about the social body. This idea that it's good to think with, good to think through. How individual bodies relate, or how this idea of a body, as well as individual bodies, relate to society. And again, lots of great examples. The idea that they give examples of populations with different descent structures, whether it be matrilineal or patrilineal, where the locus of sort of reproduction comes from. And the emphasis is on the gender that provides the lineage line. Matrilineal societies will emphasize the contribution and powers of females in successful reproduction and vice versa. You know, if anyone's done any sort of study of medieval anatomy and reproduction, you know, almost literally drawings of women with what basically is an oven, you know, inside of their bodies. The idea being that all the work is done by the baker. The oven just bakes the bread. And I thought that example where they say for 1,000 years before we even had proof or really could sort of, you know, visualize, know to some level about spermatozoa, about the ova, about the details of the reproductive process, for 1,000 years before we had the science, reproduction in Western tradition, one man, one woman, one act of conception. The end. Whereas I don't remember what society it was now, where it was, you know, copulation, implantation, copulation, birth. Because all of those acts were considered important in forming the person. The role of the you know, the male part in all of this. Talk about in the same way. So not only sort of this is the idea of society in individual to society, social order, the social body having an impact on how people understand their individual bodies, but also sort of the other way around, sort of the idea of a mountain that has a head, that has a chest, that has legs, that has arms, the sort of the embodying of a mountain. They give the example of the not the Quechua, the Qualahuava Indians. The mountain has human parts. And healers will solve problems in individual body cells by addressing the corresponding problem in the mountain. And then the example of the Dogon village plans and house floor plans, I thought was fascinating. Designed around gendered body cells. That an entire village should be laid out as if a man were laying on his back with sort of the political headquarters at the head, you know, and then different structures as you move down through the village. The individual house with male areas and female areas. And this is not unique to this population. It's people have done the analogy to suburbia in the United States with garages and gardens and kitchens and how homes are organized based on gender roles. Okay. I thought they ended this. Are we ending this section now? Or are we? Yes, they end this section in a really powerful way because they say probably what a lot of people are thinking, is that, well, this rings of such a primitiveness. This rings of such a, they just don't, because they don't have science yet. They don't know physiology. They don't know these things. So we might think that giving blood to a mountain is primitive. But then they point out, and this is the transition to the body politic, is that in most of these systems, there is a sense that the social group as a whole, so healing rituals, the sick person just sits there. The healing ritual takes place with everybody. You're feeding the mountain. It's a village ceremony to feed the mountain to take care of one person. That the social group as a whole has a greater power and control over the external world. Whereas, in many cases of contemporary biomedicine, it is the other, a very particular other, a very highly trained, isolated other in the form of the practitioner that is in control. Think of the struggles that family-centered care has in hospitals to gain a foothold, to get funding, to have space in the hospital. This is changing. Thank goodness. But they talk about this sort of alienation that people feel to others, to their bodies. They say that it expresses itself in anorexias, obsessions, and addictions. While the language we use posits that we are in control, self-alienation reflects the reality that we cannot control with language what happens to our bodies. So this idea that when a world is embodied, tying the individual to the social in a much more harmonious fashion, perhaps, may be more empowering than living in a disembodied world. Something to think about. All right, let's keep going. Body politic. The point of the body politic is that relationships between individual and social bodies, they say, no matter what else they are about power and control. And I excerpted this quote because I think it's relatively clear and straightforward. Cultures are disciplines that provide codes or social scripts for the domestication of the individual body in conformity to the needs of the social and political order. And we see the body politic more when there are threats to it, real or imagined threats, to any of the three bodies, the individual, the social, or the body politic. They say, through anthropological, cross-cultural, cross-historical analysis, results almost universally in a closing off of those bodies. They call it a sort of a circling of the wagons, that protectiveness. They talk about witchcraft trials. You know, times of change, got to somehow have to control it. How do you control a careening out of control social body? Try to control individual bodies. They talk about witchcraft trials. We think, oh, okay, immigration reform. I mean, to me, these smack of almost exactly the same, they are responses to the same perceived threats as the Salem witchcraft trials in some way. That, you know, with the Patriot Act, with allegations that there's communists in the Senate, there's a threat, there's a perceived threat to the social body. And under threat, those within the body politic who can exert greater control over individual bodies. And this happens on both an extreme and a mundane level. It's interesting that sort of the medical is in the they put in the mundane section. But this idea of proliferation of disease categories and labels, that there is a restricted definition of the normal and a sick and deviant majority. Oh, the female rage, bored school kids, recast as individual pathologies and symptoms, not as socially significant signs. I would argue that we could also see this in a rising concern with purity and regulating sex and marriage. with a rise in eating disorders and a spread of eating disorders to more and more populations in a post-industrialized Western context. And they have a good section, if you're interested in this kind of topic, between the difference between torture and prisons. How each system responds to a different social need and perceived threats. Okay, so I'm going, again, I'm just going to, I'll say it one more time. Interrupt at will, and I'll just keep going. So they end their chapter with a section on emotions. And they say that expressions of emotion are influenced by culture. They're shaped by culture, and culture gives meaning to emotions. I think that this struck me as very reminiscent of our point in the semester where we talked about storytelling, that they argue that you can see in emotions the unmaking and remaking of the world in the same way that we talked about with stories. And in the extreme, they agree with Geertz that without culture, we would simply not know how to feel. And perhaps they do this at the end of their article. Because remember, again, this is 1987. They're starting to see it. They're arguing for a increased attention to the body, to the varieties of bodies, to the, even if you're not just the varieties in terms of individual, social, and politic, but also within individuals, within societies, and within politics, as well as cross, you know, society, cross politics, that by ending with emotions, that it might have a greater resonance with us, because we all do have emotions. It's perhaps sort of an anthropological equivalent of, you know, a philosophical thought experiment. You know, how do you describe something you've never seen before? The only way you can do that is by harking back to other things you have seen before and making analogies. How do you learn how to feel? You learn how to feel by watching others, by listening to others, by trying different things out, that kind of thing. So they... they highlight at the start, they say, we think there's something to this because there seems to be a rise in the appearance of alternative medical heterodoxies. You know, a rise in complementary and alternative medicine. A rise in acknowledgement of different ways of treating the body. I mean, when you have very prominent people going off to retreats in Mexico to sweat cure themselves for random cancers, you know, this has reached a mainstream on some level. I think patient advocacy movements would also fall into this, that there's been enough attention to the body, there's been enough destabilization of the body and the social body and the body politic, at least as it relates to medicine, that individual bodies are starting to have alternative forms of expression. And I think we've seen those throughout this semester. Okay. How do we feel about Shepherd, Hughes, and Locke? Questions, comments? Did I miss something that you had marked in the article as particularly salient or interesting to you? All righty. Let's go on to Latour, who I cited in day one but didn't give you the article. So here it is. I cited him in the context of as an introduction to embodiment. There are pages within this that I just sort of had to skim over because he's a science studies guy, which has its own whole host of terminology, which you wouldn't think, but is actually kind of distinct from the anthropological, more social sciencey stuff. So what I've tried to do is bubble to the surface the things that I think are most clear and beneficial to sort of take with us. And one of those things is his definition of the body. And none of these three articles are exactly overlapping each other, and there's probably points of contention. But, again, nice tools for the toolkit, and you can talk about them in more detail in your log if you want. Defining the body as an interface that becomes more and more describable as it learns to be affected by more and more elements. That, luckily, he gives an example, which kind of helps. Talks about an odor kit, learning how to distinguish different smells. It says, acquiring a body is thus a progressive enterprise that produces at once a sensory medium and a sensory worldview. You know, it's this odor kit's idea is that, you know, you can systematically train noses. Again, not every nose, because there's individual variations in noses and how they're, you know, physiologically able to actually distinguish. I don't know what the nose equivalent of a rod or a cone is, but you know what I mean in terms of sensory uptake. That one can sort of train, but that training is a very particular contextualized historical process, which depended on a whole host of other people. It depended on the chemists. It depends on the industry that needs the ability to distinguish these things. It depends on the fact that human noses are better than machine noses for certain things. So it's a learning to go through this odor kit is sort of a parallel analogy to learning to be a human, in that you are learning more and more ways to distinguish differences. But not just distinguish differences, but also more and more ways to make connections. You are, what's the term he uses? Articulations. And I kind of think of it as like a joint, you know, or something that can bend. You know, it's something that has some, it brings me back to sort of the web idea. So as one learns more and more articulations, more and more ways to parse out the world around them. So he says, you're not just producing a sensory medium, you're producing a sensitive worldview. Kind of, I was sort of one of those weird flights that my brain takes sometimes. I was like, that's what I'm doing with you guys. You guys are going to walk out of here and you're going to look at bodies and go, my God, there's too many articulations there. You know, what do I do with this person? You know, sort of, if you've done any sort of qualitative coding, your whole world becomes a code book. You don't look at anybody without going, oh, 14-2. It took me months to not do that with every billboard I saw after a year-long coding endeavor. I learned a sensitive worldview based on this coding structure. And that's why I like this article a lot, because it is action-oriented. He said, if we're not action-oriented, what we're left with is simply a straightforward sender-receiver communication theory, which we debunked in class too. Sender, receiver, medium. If I say cat, you visualize that exact same cat because the medium is clear. Subjects, objects, intermediary symbolic system. That if we don't focus on the acquisition of articulations, the acquisition of discernible elements, the acquisition of particularly informed worldviews, then we're left with a very flat understanding of what we're dealing with. Subject, object, intermediate symbolic system. So it's too simplified, it is not valuable, and it in fact can be it can be a hindrance to understanding others and understanding ourselves. This verse says, the opposite of embodied is dead, not omniscient. This is how we started this semester with class one. I threw up this quote. So the subject-object intermediary symbolic system is a traditional understanding that subjects register the world through accurate statements about it, and this idea that we all converge on the singular object, the singular world. There's a shared symbolic system that connects subjects to objects, and we all partake of that. The traditional subject. So that idea is traditional subject in this quote. Ah, sighs the traditional subject. If only I could extract myself from this narrow-minded body and roam through the cosmos, unfettered by any instrument. I would see the world as it is, without words, without models, without controversies, silent and contemplative. Really? Replies the articulated body with some benign surprise. Why do you wish to be dead? For myself, I want to be alive, and thus I want more words, more controversies, more artificial settings, more instruments, so as to become sensitive to even more differences. My kingdom for a more embodied body. So, we've got all these embodied bodies. He wants to coin, I don't know if it's his term or if it comes from someone else and he's just using it or expanding it, this idea of the multiverse. He makes it very clear that he's not saying that there are multiverses. It's sort of a, you know, universe. Unitary, uniform, multiverse. He says the multiverse is exactly as real as the universe, except the latter can only register the primary qualities, while the former registers all of the articulations. And he talks a lot about primary qualities and secondary qualities. I think this is sort of a science studies background. The way I just sort of glossed over it enough to get what I needed from his writing, sort of, I kept thinking primary qualities, what we consider to be scientific fact. Secondary qualities, everything we consider to be unique to the individual, emotion, personality, these sorts of things. So he's saying that the universe is only registering primary qualities, facts of nature, subject, object, symbolic link between the two. Whereas the multiverse registers all of the articulations. It encompasses all of the different embodied people within it. It's a universe, quote, freed from its premature unification. The multiverse is something more nuanced, more accepting of multiple perspectives. It is richer and it is more complex, and it is more useful, beneficial, and ethical to think of the multiverse when you're trying to figure out why other people are doing what they're doing. And how and why. Does that make sense? Alrighty. But some of you are thinking, probably, what, if anything, can we do? Well, Latour says this as well. What can we say or do, if anything, in a normative fashion? Does this leave us, again, in the realm of, it's the multiverse, whatever, do what you will? He says no. What we need to do is look at well-articulated articulations versus badly articulated articulations. Lots of dense pages from like 216 to 220. So let's just go to his summary paragraph on page 220. He says, we have to answer the question of the difference between these between types of articulations, because if not, we appear as one more in a long line of radical postmodernism, and that is not helpful to us. And then the second question he asks is, why is it good to become more articulated? And then he goes off on the nature of science and the scientific endeavor. But I love his reframing, and I think it's very valuable if we want to sort of replace it as medicine here. Science is an adjective. And it's, our goal should be not science that provides a more accurate picture of the world, not science that gets us to the true nature of the universe, but a science as an adjective that gets us to a world of more articulated propositions. And why is that better? He says there is, he contrasts sort of good generalizing versus bad generalizing, that if you do sort of good articulations, you can see connections between disparate phenomena. That it is a, you know, it's like having an epidemiological database with 10 gazillion data points versus an epidemiological database that has two. Because a bad generalizing, a bad articulation, would be this idea of going to a core that deems everything that is remains different as irrelevant. Because the idea being that if we're going to take science as the key to the universe, what do we want? We want propositions that are true, as unproblematic as possible, so that we can have the, we can get to the core of what's going on. I'll leave it to you to determine how much you want to make an analogy to other branches of bioethics. Let's go through his example of genes, because, again, I think examples always help. So he talks about different ways of understanding, or not understanding, but different ways of approaching genes. That there are some who are looking for the universal bulldozer function of genes. You know, that, all right, you know, the ones that hold on to the genetic determinism, genetic reductionism. We just don't have the science yet to get at what that is. Versus embracing the articulations and saying a particular way of knowing genes is enriching because we see how they are engaged in many different realms. So only by withdrawing most phenomena from the multiverse can one imagine a general theory that succeeds every time it repeats the same argument. Instead, he says, we need to adopt an even riskier generalization. Again, he's saying, like, don't go all the way to individual relativistic postmodernism. Don't stop generalizing. He says, adopt an even riskier generalization. I accept being at once general and compatible with alternative versions of the universe. And I think what he's trying to say is that we, as he says here, you know, we no longer wish to have scientists coming from hard sciences to define primary qualities, while the common men and women are limited to secondary qualities. So we no longer wish that science has exclusive dominion over, quote unquote, the world as it really is, those essential ingredients, the facts of nature. Whereas, as he said, you know, his common men and women limited to cultural and personal imaginations. He says that it's, in some sense, remember that when we were talking about stories, we said, is there anything such, can there be a false story? And looked at in one perspective, no. Because even if a story appears to be an outright lie in terms of, you know, documented facts in your medical record to deny them or to change them, the point of the story is that the things you are telling yourself and others, you're doing so for a reason. So in that sense, I think that he's saying that by looking at articulations, at looking at embodiment, looking at the body in this complex, contextualized way, in some level means it can all be quote-unquote true. They're just different articulations in the multiverse. How's that one? Okay. It is impossible for a reductionist scientist to be reductionist. I love that, because then he contextualized reductionist scientists. Reductionism is not a sin for which scientists should make amends, but a dream precisely as unreachable as being alive and having no body. He's placing scientists on the same plane as other forms of knowledge producers, on equal plane in the multiverse. He is not as political as Shepard, Hughes, and Locke in terms of talking about, if he did, it didn't jump out enough at me that I'm remembering it. He did not talk about, it's a throwaway comment, that there are different players in the multiverse who have more power than others. But he's more concerned with, I think, more of a philosophical type argument about what is the body, what is embodiment, how is knowledge produced. And I think his main point is really to sort of critique the dominion of the scientific knowledge production industrial complex. So really, my next slide goes to the next article, so not that you need to speak now or forever hold your peace, but it is 20 to 6. And we have to end at like 6:15 to give you guys enough time to do the evals. All right. Let's keep going then. It was a toss-up for me to determine which order to present these articles in for today. Because they don't lead one into the other. They all just are. So I'm like, all right, let's end with this one because it, in many ways, he's the one coming from within bioethics proper. So let's end there. And he's got, between the three articles, we have a nice breakdown between the more sociological, social science form, and this guy who gives like a scientific matrix at the end, which I've diagrammed out for us. His goal is to somehow create a bridge between mainstream bioethics and more postmodern, feminist, other types of approaches to bioethics. He starts in many the same way that Latour talks about, is that in mainstream bioethics it tends towards conventional positions, which stress fixed standards of judgment, or at least fixed methods for judging. Did something just fly off? Did you?
No.
Okay. I have crickets in my basement, and I can see things jumping at me all the time. Huge. Mutant crickets. So stressing fixed standards of judgment or fixed methods of judging. What he wants to do is see if there's a way that we can maintain, on some level, a normative trend in the terms of the ability to have a systematic and processual method of ethical deliberation. You know, describing the problem, how do you analyze terms and opinions, and how do you make an evaluation or a recommendation? How can one do that while simultaneously recognizing what the postmodernists and the postfeminists and everybody has taught us, that the thing that we're used to dealing with is not just one thing, but it is a multitude of things. You know, mainstream bioethics becomes much more complicated when you embody the body and you embody context and you put things in historical contextual perspective. So he centers this whole piece on, you know, asking how can we, in light of all these different bodies and all the different ways we can consider the body, how can we well address the questions of what am I allowed to do with my own body? To what extent can I permit others to do whatever they like with their bodies? He says his goal is not to overcome all the different conflicts in the ways that the body or autonomy are considered. To force a critical reflection on how we understand the body. and how we understand autonomy, because that's in his matrix. It'll tell us how do we view the questions that are concerned to us, and how can we put ourselves in all the three other different boxes of the matrix to ask questions of the things that we're concerned about. So his paper is broken down into two parts. Part one is a two-part placing the body in ethical, social, and historical moments in places in medicine. And there's two sections there, which we'll talk about in more detail. The body is more than the locus, and talking about body limits as moral and epistemic uncertainties. And then he goes into part two, where he takes the theory that he's done in part one and gives us this embodiment crossed with autonomy scale, where he uses that matrix to talk about bodily self-determination, respect for the body, unavailability of the other, care for bodily individuality, and recognition of bodily cooperation. He's the one who says, points out, like many others before him, study of the absent body. He says, while the body is and should always be the subject slash object of medical interventions and innovations, it is included within bioethical thought, but as an object, not as a thinking, acting, embodied entity. I actually don't like that definition as much. I think we've got other clearer ones later. He also, like Shepherd, Hughes, and Locke, talks about the body boom. And in the same way, we're living with and seeing more play within the limits of the body. That the things that we can do with the body become moral questions. And he gives some great examples. The nature-culture divide, in which we are cultivating cells and artificially producing organisms. You know, sort of Ventnor's synthetic life. Studying not only life as we know it, but life as it might be. In this realm in which they're playing with the nature-culture divide, it becomes very hard, he says, to tell truth from science fiction. We have play between human person and machine. So, for example, we're manipulating the mind by brain-implanted chips or brain-computer interfaces. We have play between human beings and animals, human-animal chimeras, or using animal organs as transplant material. There's a huge play between the animal-human divide. Internal-external, in which you're sort of questioning the ownership of an explanted organ or an embryo created in vitro. And perhaps slightly more out there, but one might have said manipulating the brain with a brain-implanted chip was slightly out there and really not possible a few years ago. Transplantations of brain tissue to really play with the body-mind distinction. Why is he doing all this, and what's his point? He wants to say that that this multiplicity of interpretations and conceptualizations of the body in bioethics, that there are all these things, and that it's the conflicting assumptions about what the body is that may result in conflicting ethical judgments. This is almost like one of those checks, you know, with, let's make sure we're all speaking the same language here. You know, that when I say body, you know, we need to make clear how are we interpreting it. Because if we don't, we're each going to assume the other interprets it the way we do, and we're not going to never ever check on that assumption, and then our discussions up here are going to be warped and potentially very conflicting because we're working off of different foundations. So, then part two, he takes embodiment and autonomy on two axes, the liberal communitarian and the materialist deconstructivist. His point is that we need to be critically sensitive to our own premises on what autonomy and the body mean. On the autonomy scale, from liberal to communitarian, the way of thinking closer to the liberal end of the spectrum refers to the capability, real or potential, of a person to act and decide independently of external influence and power. That should sound very mainstream. Liberal perceptions of the self and autonomy is the foundation for contemporary bioethics. On the other end of the axis, and again, I could have flipped those. There's no value placed in terms of what's on top or what's on the right and what's on the left, other than perhaps my subconscious embodiment that I don't know. A communitarian on that axis would look at autonomy more in the sense of a relational autonomy that focuses on social responsibilities and relations, that integrates biology, socio-cultural factors, and biographic elements of a person's life. Does that make sense, that distinction between the liberal and the communitarian? Because we're going to do a little exercise, so we need to all make sure we understand what these terms mean. And it's a group, so you can work them out together as well. All right, well, the other axis with body, we have materialist and deconstructivist. The materialist is, again, think of classic stereotypical biomedicine, a reduction of the physicalness of the body to its materiality. And he uses the term deconstructivist. I should have put this in the slide, but I have it in my notes, that I put / social constructivist. I think that makes a lot more sense than deconstructivist. And whether or not they're exactly the same or different, it almost doesn't matter for what we're doing with his exercise here. He says people typically live in one of those four zones. Although it is possible that as we consider different areas, we may move from being a liberal materialist to a social constructivist communitarian, although he argues that is rarer. I think in the same way as Autumn argues in 602, that we all have sort of a default. Are we utilitarians? Are we deontologists? You know, if we think about it long enough, we can kind of see where we live comfortably. I think we all sort of, I think it's true that we sort of live in one of those four boxes more comfortably than others, which probably informs how we think about bioethical issues, but we may not realize it, which is the whole point of throwing up this matrix. So what we're going to do in the next, I just want to take 10 minutes because y'all have been too quiet. And I got one more chance. And I want to make sure that we feel confident that we can put this in our own words and get it on some level. Again, you've heard me say multiple times, I may not know if deconstructivist is the same as social constructivism, but I don't care. You know, so if you can substitute a term or substitute a way of thinking about it that still makes sense and fits the type of, you know, you're in either a rainforest or the Sahara, you know, your tree fits. It, you know, just as long as you're in the right forest, you're good. What he does in the last few pages, because I'm going to break us up into four groups and I'm going to give you each a zone. What he does, and I'll tell you where he starts this. What page is this? Page 7 of 12, if you copied it from where I got it from, where he outlines his matrix. And then he breaks it down, starting on page 8, into these four zones. And I'll have to put on the board which ones they are. Well, top left, the liberal materialist, is the, where he subtitles that section, bodily self-determination. So let's just say, 1, 2, 3, 4, from Sheena up. You guys are liberal materialists. Okay. Olivia, Renata, Christine, and Hila, you guys are going to be liberal deconstructivists. Respect for the bodily unavailability of the other. And I'll explain what I want you to do. I just want to make sure everyone's in the right zone. You guys are zone two. Robin, David, Jeff, and Casey. You guys are going to be... Oh, I went the wrong way, didn't I? Two is at the bottom. You guys in the corner, I went the wrong way. You're materialist communitarians. Exit corner are liberal deconstructivists. Care for bodily individuality. And you three are zone four, which is the bottom right. You are communitarian social constructivists. So, what I want you to do, and I have a slide for each of these, I just want you to do it first. I will give you a hint as well. You're also going to want to look on page 9, 10, 11, and it pretty much goes in order. Right-hand column, top is zone 1. Bottom paragraph through the page 10 is zone 2. Zone 3 is the next big paragraph, and zone 4 is the other paragraph. What he does in the first section is he tries to explain what he's talking about. Then he comes back to it, and he gives examples. What he's going to do, so for example, those of you in zone 1, you liberal materialists, what I want you to do, and make the analogy to your group, this is what I want everyone to do. What does it mean, just in your own words, then use the argument that he gives. So, for example, zone one, he talks about body modification and how that might be talked about from a liberal materialist perspective, which then transitions him to organ sales and transplantation. He says, if you are a liberal materialist and you make this argument, a liberal materialist may have to then make this type of argument in a different type of bioethics case. But then he says, well, what happens if you want to make this argument from a liberal materialist perspective, which is logical, theoretical, it fits your definition of body and your definition of autonomy. How might someone else look at your problem? So he gives an example of what a communitarian materialist might look like. And so the communitarian materialistic is going to look at your perspective as liberal materialists and say, what about this? So, if you take an opposing position and ask a question of the other, you can better see the assumptions and limitations of your argument. I know that seems like a lot, and I'm really not asking for that much. I really want us to spend 10 minutes talking about your zone. Start with page 8 and 9, wherever he talks about your zone, and then go to page 10, 11, 12. What examples does he give? Try to excerpt those in your own words. Try to figure out what the hell he's talking about, and then we'll go over it. And it's 5 to 6. So let's say, I think 10 minutes should probably be more than enough. Because again, it doesn't have to be exhaustive. Just talk about the terminology. And let's have people who are gone can be liberal materialists.
Yeah,
no,
I got it.
And you're welcome, like, sometimes read it out loud to each other, and then someone can say, oh, that makes sense. Stop, I don't get that. That helps.
Yeah.
I guess maybe we should first.
Autonomy has the right to bodily self-discrimination, refers in this review to the defense of one's own body against direct and indirect interventions by third parties. The body represents the immediate access to one's own personality, i.e., to express one's own opinion by a body modification, and at the same time can be regarded materialistically as a transformable entity. Autonomy remains fixed to the specific bodily and conveyed capabilities of personal identity, i.e., to communication, to coping with pain, to the conscious realization of personal characteristics. However, this view does not have to lead to the conclusion that an instrumentalization of the body always means an instrumentalization of the person, and that the interventions in question are instituted by this person, and the natural basis for this person's identity remains intact.
So I guess that means
no, that's a community.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't care about yourself.
I can do whatever I want whenever I want to.
Sort of what I was saying. And that they can always maybe even take you a step further. I don't know if that's actually good, but consider that they do it without consideration for how it affects other bodies and expression.
That sort of makes sense. I don't know why, but yeah.
Like it centralizes on like your body, and so they don't think about other bodies in respect to their actions.
And stabilization of an identity as conveyed through sexuality, appearance as bodily characteristic and bodily traits, such as in the acts of eating or moving. Such bodily features are always situated within a complex understanding of individual normality, of political and social standardization, and of historical and cultural differences.
Page 9.
So just real quick, is this the construction aspect with like this is like kind of the same principle?
I can do whatever I want.
No, it's hard, but I have faith.
Top, where it says you can see it.
Yes, you do. You do. You have all the tools. Right.
That this liberal materialist viewpoint can be used to vehemently justify the right to have any kind of body modification as long as there's informed consent.
That's awesome. Yeah. I'm totally a deconstructivist.
Nice little summary right in the first
sentence. I guess that's probably the
oh, okay.
When people sign over and sign, decide to take away the right to, like, you know what I mean, Britney Spears, for example.
Autonomy is the opportunity to
have
the
conservatorship.
I have no idea what I know who she is.
Do you know how she's, like, under a conservatorship?
Ding, ding, ding.
So her dad has all the financial and personal control over her, like, to the point
where,
I mean, not...
I had to break it down to separate, so copy and paste this, and copy and paste separate things. All right, so basically this is saying...
But now what they're doing...
Communitarian...
They used it to, like, keep her out of testifying in some court case, like, as a witness. But now they're getting her married.
I guess. It sounds kind of redundant because you can basically... It almost
which
sounds like
you're
saying
that
you have the right to be self-defined, completely self-autonomous, but that right's not realized until you find another group that feels the same way as you do.
Why
did
you say
that? Right,
but doesn't that flies completely against the whole idea? It's like the kid who wants to look different but looks like every other goth kid on the street.
That's exactly the point. If you want to just if you want to be a rebellious individual, there's only certain ways you can do
it.
So,
I guess that's what I'm saying.
One year to construct themselves, and they're doing so based on norms and ideologies. To the extent to which that's a process, very extent.
Right. So the ultimately, though, the self of being the sense of being an autonomous person is really a felt need, not real. Because our autonomy is, you know, because you find yourself in a group, you're therefore no longer truly autonomous. So,
but it's a, see, you jumped out of that zone one. You would have been very comfortable in zone one.
Yeah. So she's not in the liberal material.
Because there's no such thing as real autonomy. There's different types.
Right. He has.
It's not more autonomous, communitarian, less autonomous.
Right.
It's liberal autonomy.
When who gets to
community, relative.
Right.
Relative meaning in relation to others.
Okay.
You know, there's young men who go out.
Mutually, constitutive, like put them in their wills, right?
So I'm just
kind of getting out of it.
And, yeah, no, definitely. And
you're yourself,
that,
but you're yourself affected by the other groups.
Right.
And that's reflected in the group.
No, I'm sure.
Yes. And that's the thing about how you like, okay, you got me. Pulmonaries.
Okay.
What makes zone 4 distinct from zone 3?
Absolutely. Yeah, like, where
zone 4.
Yeah. A special case of possible commercialization.
Yeah, and how do you set up a system for that? Our music.
They're all on a
continuum.
Right.
But
right.
IPads
in Japan.
Right. It's like inherently.
Yeah. Well, I guess zone 3 would be less concerned with.
I thought that happened like 3 or 4 years ago.
True. Yes. Right. There you go. Great. All right. Perfect.
Yeah, okay. So our folks, we strive for but we also strive for.
Maybe he was trying to raise money, or he was trying to do it 3 or 4 years ago. But 3 or 4 years ago isn't
really
something. Maybe it was a different pit. Well, that's what it was. It was a kid getting an iPad and an iPod 3 or 4 years ago, an iPhone and an iPad.
But it can be family and disease.
But that would fit into liberal materialism. Although I think it can be
social relationships of parenting and friendship.
Then we think about,
well, then there's that whole law thing.
Groups express themselves.
Who can choose whether, like the autonomy law, make sure versus autonomy.
Relationship of bodily contact and sharing of bodily experience with social relationships of parents.
I think that's
just the exact. Let's go to the examples, because sometimes that helps. He gives two examples. He talks about cochlear implants and patient self-help groups.
Interesting.
So the question is, does body modification form cochlear implants? How would a deconstructivist communitarian understand that? Because people are constantly arguing about cochlear implants. You know, is it enhanced?
To get your organs versus
segregating that child from his community. Should society make accommodations? Why do we change a person? All these are disability rights type thing, plus with the whole deafness culture laid on top of that. So one of the things that he is saying here is, if you're going to make an argument, you've got to and then when you get into an argument with someone else, and we talk about patient self help.
Perspective 4, he says, the last sentence of that paragraph, if a person's autonomy is linked only to current bodily self-determination and constructs the body as a physical instrument, further reaching claims such as the societal obligation to help for other patients with organs,
a social constructivist communitarian would focus more on the political power of similar people coming together who share a condition, who share concerns. So if you want to talk about what is the role of patient support groups, they're both true and valid, but you're just going to have a different perspective on how you want to argue for them.
and what happens.
Well, I can ask the question as far as the whole planetarian is that if cochlear implants could separate a person from one community, but actually may lead them to join a new community.
Right.
So the emphasis is on the communitarian, being in a community, being rooted to it.
Are you interpreting this? I think that's what I am. That it might be an argument against cochlear implants because cochlear implants, depending on how you talk about them, maybe a zone 1 type of response to deafness.
Right. Well, it says here, for instance, as signified by loss of sunlight due to the use of cochlear implants, or whether it also contributes to the gestation of newborns or the development of new collectives.
Just what this is saying is you can't have any bodily self-determination.
They're still in that same segment of the window. They're just whatever their choice is to get the implant moves them from one to
the other. Well, right, what would the liberal
material be? Yet they're still distinct. They still are autonomous, but
not
they now are moving from a
same
societal sign language into a new community. Probably even a smaller community.
Transition.
And it's less important that we reach an answer to those questions, but what type of questions are you talking about? What types of questions are you going to ask of cochlear implants?
That's what I'm
of neuro enhancements, you know, these types of things. I think one of the other examples from one of the other zones talks about cosmetic surgery. A liberal materialist is going to argue that as long as there's informed consent, you have the exact right to do whatever you want to your body. But a communitarian materialist would come back and say, well, might there be, sure, you have the right to do whatever you want with your body, but should we also think about the effect on the community of this many people making this decision? At what point, if ever, does it cease to be a purely individual liberal decision? And at what point does it become a cultural, societal issue?
You think I'll take your,
you know, it's, right. It's not really like the slippery slope of our argument. Maybe this has something to do with like deontology versus, you know, consequentialism, perhaps. But I don't want to make that analogy.
I mean, just in the middle here, it says.
But it's just sort of like, oh, you're right. If I think about autonomy from a relational perspective, and I think about the body from a social constructist perspective,
oh, the former distinction between human being and machine, mind and body is blurred by the technology itself.
And does that help me ask different questions? Does it solidify my own perspective? So it's really just, this is all about playing,
blurring,
with, it's like those telescopes, you know, you click the thing, or, no, like an eye doctor, you know, they put the different lenses in. What does this question look like if I put a communitarian lens on it? Oh, I didn't see those things before.
Who you are,
I like that.
How do you
really
define with it? Because like the whole identity thing gets confusing.
That's good stuff. That's good.
Depending on what's going to change or how you want to change your brain.
Oh, it's 6:10. All right, so let's bring it back together. I just said something over here to my communitarian social constructivists. Yo, group 3.
Well, we're here.
Yes. I know you were. but I want us to all talk as a group now. So I just said something to group 4, which I probably should have said before, but the point of these discussions was not to come up with an answer. It was, and the analogy we sort of came to was, you know, when you're at the eye doctor and they switch those different lenses in, and the world looks different, fuzzier, bigger, you know, that you have a problem. Not a problem in the sense of, you know, this is a problem. You have an issue, something. And you can put different lenses over your eye, and as you do that, different aspects of that issue are going to come into relief, which will then lead you to ask different questions about it. So part of this was, none of this was to come up with the sort of right answer to what the problem is. It was to play with the ideas of how questions look different with these different lenses. You know, they're like, oh, I never thought that if somebody was a purely if someone had a conception that was purely liberal perspective on autonomy, but they were also a social constructivist, those are two very distinct lenses that bring into relief different issues. And I know this is probably the hardest article that we read this semester. But I included it because I knew you could do it. okay, so let's go through. Let's go to our liberal materialists. Which, depending on your lens, can sound like a real insult.
So after what you just said, this gets kind of interesting, because the little scenario that we had is the person's dead. So how do you...
Oh, yeah.
So liberal materialists, I guess in lay terms, could be you can do whatever you want as long as you have informed consent to yourself. And we kind of went a little further that maybe it doesn't even matter what other people might think about that, because it's your choice and you get to determine this. We had a little side conversation about what that means for Britney Spears right now. If somebody wants
like
to explain
her conservatorship because how she's marrying. Well, I just think it's interesting because she's kind of actually it's the opposite of liberal materialism, but she's marrying the man who's also being transferred, like her conservatorship is being transferred to him too.
Oh.
And they used her conservatorship to legally like get her out of testifying in a case against like Sam Lofty. Followed that back in the day.
Yeah.
But anyways, so she was just a witness and had to testify about something, and she didn't do that because she wasn't found mentally competent to, because she's under a conservatorship.
Wow.
And so they're switching it from her dad to her husband, which just, we were wondering, you know, like, in terms of even sex and rape and all of that, like, because he's allowed to make personal decisions for her. If she says no, can he decide for her yes?
Because you're redefining autonomy.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
I don't know. I thought it was really interesting.
That is. And let's explore it later. I want to get back to the dead people and the organs.
Sorry.
No, but I love that. I told you could get tools to look at anything, says our future lawyer. You know, what is? Maybe you'll have a conservatorship case in the future, and all of this will come back to you.
So on the way to being dead, there's the question of, so if you can do whatever you want with your body, can you sell your own organs? And then we brought up the example of the teenager in China who decided to sell a kidney for an iPad and an iPhone, and now he's going into renal failure with his other kidney, I think. And then it goes to how the whole being a liberal materialist, that might get confused slightly when you add technology into the mix and combine person with instruments and machines. Although I think it gets even more confusing when the person is dead and it's not just combining the two pieces, but they go straight to being dead. And so you're dead, but you're, I guess, brain dead possibly, but body cells are kept alive by having the blood pumped through and a respirator moving oxygen in and out. And that if an individual refused to have organs taken out to donate while alive, once they're dead, is it possible that they no longer have bodily self-determination, because bodily self-determination is in a current state and you have to give informed consent? So can a societal obligation sort of overtake that and mean that your organs can be taken out and given away or sold or whatever?
Perfect. What they did is, so they laid out what a liberal materialist perspective was and then sort of said, so it's the case with the guy in China with the renal failure. And I'm trying to think of sort of analogies here with the whole issue of illegal immigrant children, fetuses, you know, different levels of control over women's bodies and obligations to what comes out of those bodies. A liberal materialist would say, sure, he has a right to sell his organ, but do we have an obligation to then take care of him, you know, as a communitarian relational autonomy would? And I think it just provides more oomph and weight and theoretical foundations for any type of argument that you want to make. And is a good arguing tool in terms of finding the inconsistencies in the other side. Okay, but since you are all going to evaluate me, I won't go off on my pro-life, pro-choice diatribes. Okay, any questions for group one? All right, so let's see what the world looks like when we take the materialism, switch out the liberal lens, switch in the relational autonomy communitarian lens. Think. Respect for bodily unavailability of the other as sort of a key theme.
It was hard for us to fully grasp the idea.
Okay.
I think we discussed the maybe that it means that when you respect the other's moral autonomy, it also respects your I think it restricts the universality of your own moral autonomy. And how, yeah.
It's sort of like, I kind of, in my mind, made the analogy, you can, I fight for your right to stand up on a soapbox and yell everything that I vehemently disagree with because I value my right to be able to do that as well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's that bodily unavailability of the other. You know, that you can't interfere, you can't encroach because you're respecting the rights of both. But the focus is more on the others as opposed to the liberal materialists who could say care less about the other people. Okay, so, all right. You got there. You're there. Should we... Would it help if I say talk about boob jobs?
We saw it's not exactly boob jobs, but my analogy was that, like, if we accept that, like, when I think of body modification, I think of, like, piercings and, you know, that sort of thing. So, like, we accept somebody's right to do things to their bodies that we wouldn't necessarily, A, object to for ourselves, but also object to actually being just seen or experiencing. And I use the example of a friend of mine whose husband has split his tongue. So he's got, like, a snake tongue.
Yeah.
You know, although every time I see him, I go, think about, you know. But he's got every right to do that. But then I guess the other side to that would be how, when you choose to do those things, what impact it has on the people that you interact with on a daily basis, or that kind of thing.
The culture.
Right.
Which I'm surprised that's why you didn't go to boob jobs and cosmetic surgery. Okay. Because that's, I think, particularly as a parent, where one starts to, I think more about the communitarian perspective. What he says is you could take a liberalist, materialist perspective and say, all right, surgery on an adult woman is often legitimized with reference to bodily self-determination, informed consent, but a materialist communitarian would ask us to think about the proliferation of cosmetic surgery in a different way by asking the question, is it possible that this successive implicit social compulsion, would it, by sort of normalizing and routinizing and, I'm not going to say normalize it again, lead to the possibility of successive implicit social compulsion for the next generation. The moral dimension of such individually legitimate decisions unveils ethical problems for those who are rather dependent on cultural standards such as adolescence. So it's keeping the materialist basis, but shifting the locus of decision making from this abstracted rational mind to potential cultural impacts on how people think about what is normal. And may that have an effect on others.
It's not a full restriction, but it's a kind of a warning sign. Think of the larger implications of individual actions.
Right, right. So that if you were called to an ethics meeting, and or you know you were called to a board that wanted to talk about distributing pharmaceutical samples in hospitals to incredibly poor patients, you know, or whatever. These are different ways to think, all right, I know my questions from over here. What happens if I shift my lens? Are there other questions that we should be addressing? Kind of like for those of us who work in offices, you know, sort of administrative-y type of jobs, so every decision, sometimes you just end up making them, and you don't stop to think about them anymore. And that's when you get into trouble. Because something happens down the line, I didn't think about that. You know, so it's sort of one of those, let me just pause and check. You know, do I feel like I've got the ethical landscape here? Have I thought about every possible ramification of this decision? You know, in a work environment, translated that to an ethics sort of committee type thing. Okay. Okay, let's go to three. I'm excited. Don't trust me, you will be too. Maybe just need some drinks. Okay, group three. Everything's better.
It really is. Science is.
Autonomy and the view of the body is important to living a good life, as I think what we kind of came sussed out in the beginning. So, like, social constructs. Of how one views their own body is important to living a life, to their living a life.
Right, and we were saying that a lot of it has to do with, like, subcultures of recognizing and, like, celebrating individuality as, like, coexisting within a same culture. Like, it's sort of... but it's very, very, like... This one was just weird to us. We're like, it's kind of like hedonist, like, bourgeois, like, you know, very, very... self-oriented, and it just sort of what was difficult was trying to suss out how an individual can interpret a good life for them and what the problems there might be, because that might get in the way of a good life for a different person, and it also might make them feel like above or beyond the law in some cases. We were thinking, like, one example we came up with was like sex selection with like PGD, like just saying I want to only have female children because that is my idea of a good life. And then I know you're talking about end of life care also.
Yeah, kind of along the lines of what they're saying. It's like we kind of threw up the hedonistic thing, you know, just to kind of underscore what you were saying. It's like, all right, but then at the other end of the spectrum, we were talking about the gender selection thing, but then also where you start to draw the boundaries, you know, because if we're correct in our thinking that it is pretty much your life to do what you want to do with, you know, without harming someone else, how much of that is acceptable, you know, so what becomes like the definition of what's acceptable kind of life there, what becomes acceptable for any of a number of different things in terms of kind of along the lines of what she was saying. It's like, all right, you're not harming me. I should respect your right to do something like this. But at the same time, I don't know how you actually do that. It's almost a very idealistic notion that we can all live and let live without recognizing that there would be some ramifications to this. There's got to be some limits to it.
I love end of life. That is a perfect example. Because it gets into the social construction of what is considered appropriate care, what are the range of possibilities, who gets to decide, which is sort of, you know, if anyone's taking, well, you're not because you're in this class. If you were taking Zeke's class, you'd be talking about rationing and sort of the communitarian relational autonomy, how that conflicts with liberal autonomy in a socially constructed setting in which things are not just completely materialistic but are embedded in not the terminology he would use by any means, but you know, embedded in a socially constructed, socio-historically situated space. I love that.
Oh.
other thing that I think you would like that I guess goes with it too would be, you know, saying about situating yourself like in your own like culture, even if like that's like even if it's like abnormal, so like wanting to like, I don't know, only have deaf children or you know, like live in a community of like little people or something. Or donut heads. We're talking about Japan. Where they inject saline in their foreheads and make it look like a donut. Just to go clubbing.
I have not seen that on Gawker yet.
Oh,
which, you know,
you can read
it. Okay, I'll find it.
But yeah, we were just sort of talking about like sort of like how it's sort of stretching like one culture to encompass many subcultures and cannot be like problematic or whatnot because it seems accepting. But I think it seems accepting so long as everyone is getting their personal good who's involved.
Right, like on the matrices it can kind of be shown as like one is defined by how different they are from others, and mm-hmm. this is kind of like what he says it pretty much overtly there, but what you consider yourself, what is important to you, what is good life for you, you know, being the top, is contingent upon the constructs of everything around you and what your constructs you have accepted.
Perfect. All right. Let's go to four.
Well, I'm lost because the donut heads, I think, is a perfect example of what we felt was our group was, you know.
And they weren't saying that it fit there. It's like what to think about.
Yeah, autonomous, you know, determinations of who you are and things about you mm-hmm. and how that's realized in community. And so you end up living that out in context with others mm-hmm. who share those same differences. So mm-hmm. we've reached the end of my ability to communicate on that.
Well, we were talking about the cochlear implants mm-hmm. and how by getting them and raising ethical questions about them and questioning what's going to happen to the person who gets them, you start in one group and you end up in another. And is that good? Or is that bad? And how that affects the person and how that affects the group. And, like, you are who you are, but you're in a group, and everything you do is kind of affected by the group.
And who has the right to make a decision, then?
I think it's the
for
group.
The group. Oh, no, you don't need to answer that.
Oh, okay.
But that would be what a zone 4 person might consider. You know, that they're going to say it's not just the individual in question to
right.
do whatever they want with their bodies, because our bodies mean so much more, and we exist in relation to other people. So therefore, if we want to look at the potential impacts of cochlear implants, that's a set of questions. We need to figure out sort of who the experts are, who do we talk to, how do we understand that realm, which is particularly hard because if you're not a member of the group, but then, you know, not everybody who's in a group has equal impressions of the group, you know, what's going on with the group, has authority to speak for the group, has political, you know, it's, so these are not, these zones are not to be like, aha, this is where I find the answer, but it's, oh, let me think of the problem in this way. That would, okay, you may not think so, but I thought that was awesome. So, last slide. This article, and in some parts of the whole course, was designed to destabilize. I think I said that on day one. I said, I'm going to destabilize what you think about the body. I'm going to destabilize what you think about medicine. I'm going to, you know, that whole thing. But then we're going to build it back up, kind of like the army. loss of self-evident truths. That we've opened up to the, we've opened our eyes up, our lenses up, to the various relationships between autonomy and embodiment, and how that can lead to more nuanced, more ethical reflection about questions such as who can decide about one's own body and about the bodies of others. We've seen the moral relevance of the body, and I mean, at some level, this was probably more extreme and out there on day one than it is now, but it's always good to remember, is that we need to take into account the ways how it is important the way we perceive what a body is, our own body and other bodies, and how they relate to each other, and what are the limits of the different types of bodies and relationships. And if we can embody bioethics, we have a more ethical bioethics. And that is my last slide. Okay. Cool. Please don't jump up.